Okay.
Chief Justice, Associate Justice, Judge Sabatino, counsel, may it please the court. Myself and my firm represent Philip and Phyllis Pantano, obviously here today to have you affirm the appellate division's decision reinstating the verdict in their favor. I have three main topics. The first was the certified question as to whether or not the borrowed servant doctrine was a question of law or a question of fact. I obviously, based on the argument of counsel, would like to address what the specific agreement was on the record at the trial level. And then, obviously, that oral argument had transpired into what was the second question, which this court specifically said that they weren't going to take. There was an argument of applying Galveo to the specific facts of the matter. But I believe Justice Wehner Apter, with just referencing one document of the evidence, shows that there were clearly evidence that the appellate division was correct, that the plaintiff did not get the inferences to which they were entitled to at the trial level. Beginning very simply with whether this is a question of law or fact, borrowed servant doctrine is like any other employer-employee relationship. It's a question of fact. We went through in our supplemental briefing a brief history of the control test, the business furtherance test, and started from the macro position, citing, I believe it was Saris versus A.A. Pruzik, which shows our longstanding New Jersey jurisprudence stating that determinations of vicarious liability are questions of fact for the jury to decide. Obviously, under our summary judgment standard, motion for a directed verdict, motion for judgment, which are all essentially the same standard, if it's so one-sided, it can be decided as a matter of law, but they are questions of fact for the jury. So answering this court's question as to the borrowed servant issue, it certainly was a question of fact. The model jury charge was brought up. It's now 510H, I think it used to be 510I. Clearly, it gives all the factors as to what a jury has to consider. Again, and there's annotations with case law, which we cited, again, saying it's a question of fact. The ambiguity in this case came because in Galveo, the court didn't say one way or the other. It was a very unusual procedural case. There happened to be one witness that the judge took testimony from to decide the summary judgment motion, and I think that sort of influenced counsel at the beginning of the case. But the reality was, and we cited to the transcript, both at the appellate level and in our initial opposition to the certification in the supplemental briefing, that at times both sides were calling it a legal question. Both sides were then saying it could be decided as a matter of law. And ultimately, at two critical times, which are certainly cited in our brief, our supplemental brief, I believe it's transcript 6. At page 104, plaintiff had rested and counsel for MT was about to make a motion under Rule 437, which has the same standard as a 440 motion. And they decided that they wanted to put on more evidence on the borrowed servant doctrine issue and it would only move once at the end of the case under the 440 standard. That's not plaintiff's counsel saying that. That's defense counsel stating what they're going to do. Clearly, nowhere in the transcript did either side say that this was a bench trial. The agreement was specific. I agree. It was explicit. And as I briefed here, that the motion was going to be made under 440. Normally, that gave the plaintiff certain advantages, as the appellate division pointed out. That was our reasoning for not letting this question go to the jury. Quite frankly, it is a complicated question. We tried to give the example in our briefing of, you know, every day jurors have to make decisions, and they make them in complex medical malpractice cases, but this wasn't a rear-end motor vehicle hit where people might have some knowledge about driving cars and things of that nature. They'd have to sit down and weigh all these factors between business interplay and the relationship of employee-employer. Plus, they didn't have to accept all my evidence as true, the jury. They didn't have to give me every reasonable inference. Why wouldn't the plaintiff have wanted this motion, this issue, to be decided under the 440 standard? To say that plaintiff never raised that issue at the trial level or the appellate level is also incorrect. The trial court requested after this trial, said, 440 gives me some leeway. It's really a short period of time, but I'll take more. I'm going to reserve on the decision. And there was significant post-trial briefing.
Let me ask you something. Sure. You thought it was strategically in your client's favor to take this issue from the jury and have the judge consider on a 440 standard, which is very much pro-plaintiff.
Correct, Your Honor.
And it I think we're hearing you loud and clear that was wrong, that was not, this should have gone to the jury.
No, I'm not saying that it was wrong. That was the agreement.
Understand.
And why
understand.
We agreed to
it. You're
saying
this is a jury issue.
Yes, you can't read the case law and say that, I know the Supreme Court back in 2004 didn't say, oh, we're ruling as a matter of law, which would indicate to you it was a question of fact.
I know your argument. I'm just simply asking you to confirm that you are here arguing that the appropriate fact finder in with respect to this issue is a jury.
Correct.
Okay, so here's my problem with what the appellate division did. Tell me what I'm missing here. You are saying only a jury can decide this issue, right?
Well, no, that's not necessarily true. Obviously, if the facts are so one-sided, which, to be honest with you, both sides believed that they were going to win that motion, hands down.
Barring summary judgment,
right?
Okay, there are issues that can be taken away from the fact finder because, as a matter of law,
right,
there's only one. The facts all go in one direction. You are saying that if there are facts going in both directions, this must go to the jury as a matter of legal principles that you want this court to articulate in this case.
Yes, if on the certified question, but that's not what the agreement was.
It's an element of your burden of proof in this case, right? It's an element in order to get to vicarious liability, you have to win on that issue.
Correct. You would have to prove that the general employer, Marine Transport, MT, had at least some type of control and some type of economic benefit from it. And as I pointed out in the briefing, and Galveo also specifically says, it could be dual.
Okay.
We're not saying one over the other.
Some issues were submitted to the jury, but that was not one of them.
Correct.
So nobody has, under your formulation, which is that it's a jury question, no fact finder, the proper fact finder, never decided that.
Correct.
So how could the appellate division reinstate the verdict, given the fact that no jury had determined that?
Because that's what the parties agreed to, Justice Patterson. And on the record, when counsel made the motion, he acknowledged, I have the heavy burden. And to say that it was jointly, we had said jointly, yes, Judge, we'd like to decide this issue. How he brought that motion and
why shouldn't this go back so a jury determines that issue?
Because that's the agreement that was made. And represented defendants.
Where does it say that about a final remedy in the case if it turned out you were wrong? You're saying if what you are saying is we agreed to it, therefore no jury should decide this issue, then the trial judge determination should not be reversed on appeal.
Yes, but we didn't agree to it. I wouldn't have agreed to a bench trial on the issue agreed to that because ultimately
he would have had the burden of proof.
Right. And the way the agreement was is that why wouldn't I take that, right? Why wouldn't, and you know, I was up front with this court that why wouldn't I take that advantage? If he loses the 440 motion, we're just going to tell the jury, you know, you decide if Giamella was.
I think you're looking to get the benefit of your agreement to some degree because you view it as a strategic agreement, but you want it undone in other respects, which is that you think that it ultimately gave the wrong fact finder the responsibility of determining the borrowed servant question.
No, Your Honor, my distinction to that is the agreement was, defense is going to make their motion, but it's going to be under the 440 standard. If they win it, we're done. Plaintiff loses. If we defeat that, we are then just going to have the jury decide the case as if MT is vicariously liable, understanding the questions left open. I'm not asking anyone to undo anything. That was the agreement made.
But what I'm saying is that if this was sent back for a reinstatement of the jury verdict, then what you are saying should have happened has never happened, and that is a jury deciding on this question of fact. And I'm saying that I know you're a good lawyer. You're trying to get the best strategy and pull out of this really odd procedural situation the advantages to your client. But the question here is, if you are telling us, and if we decide you are right, that this is a question of fact that goes to a jury, it needs to go to a jury, doesn't it?
No, I don't think so. That was in a form of any other type of partial settlement, high-low agreement.
So, no, wait a second, though. But you're now wanting to get out from under the giving the court the determination to be made as a matter of law. You want out from under that.
No, Your Honor, I'm not. Because that application...
You're telling us that it was an error for the court to make that determination.
Judge, on the critical day, it was December 10th, that's transcript number 7, and it says Mr. Minter, but I think both sides have said this is me speaking. Starts as page 9 of the transcript, line 16. This is when the trial court was like, can we stop for a second? Because the trial court turned the boat around, or turned the ship around, I think he said. And I think both Mr. Minter and I, my co-counsel, Mr. Galaxy, and even Mr. Limbaugh Connor were like, oh, we just had 6 days of trial. Please don't do that to us. And I clearly said on the record, on the next two pages, that, Judge, I don't know if it's a question of law or a question of fact. You can decide it under the 440 motion, and I'm locked into that procedure, just like Mr. Minter said he's locked into that procedure, under the 440 standard.
Did the judge ever decide the 440 motion?
He did.
And how did he decide it?
He decided against the plaintiff, but he didn't do it under the 440 standard. He made findings of fact.
Was the error that the appellate division found, or should have found, that he failed to apply the 440?
We're very clear on that he did not, that the trial court did not apply the 440 standard correctly.
And if that's the case, then your argument is no jury, no trier of fact has to find borrowed servant. I win because that was our agreement.
Correct. It's just like if you had a high-low agreement or any other partial settlement agreement of how a case was going to be tried. That they knowingly went into that. Counsel started his argument knowing that he had a heavy burden to win that motion. And I cited that for this court, and I cited it for the appellate division. They didn't unknowingly walk into that.
Part of your agreement was an agreement that this whole issue goes to the judge. And you're now telling us that was wrong.
No, it goes to the judge under the 440 standard. That's very clear on the record.
If this is an issue, counsel, that is properly for a jury, and you're arguing that, what am I missing here? In this case, you are saying this goes to a jury. Right?
Correct.
Okay. So if you're right, then what went on in the trial court was wrong. Should never have happened.
I have to respectfully disagree with that, Justice Patterson. It is an agreement that was first prompted by defense counsel. We'll have the judge decide it on a motion for judgment at the end of the case.
So so under the rule that you would have this court adopt, if somebody tries to do what you and your co-counsel did in that case and tell the trial court, we don't know, we think it's for you, Your Honor, you would be having this court say that would be wrong. It's an issue that ought to go to the jury, right?
It's an issue that ought to go to the jury.
Unless waived, right? Well, in other words, if you have a right to jury trial,
right,
at times people waive it. They
right.
choose to, for strategic or other reasons, they choose not to take advantage of that jury trial.
Right.
Isn't one interpretation of what happened here is you're saying generally, going back to Volb and so on, the cases are clear, it's a jury question. In this case, because of the option that was presented, your client waived that opportunity to have a jury do it because you thought it was to your advantage. Jury access can be waived mutually in lots of cases, right?
Right, and on that issue, the parties had agreed, the agreement that was made on the record and initially suggested by defense counsel and acknowledged by defense counsel was, we'll do it under a motion for judgment standard. Why wouldn't I accept that as the plaintiff's counsel?
That's a huge advantage. Did you waive that issue? Did your client waive the right to a jury determination on that issue?
Yes, I had a, the judge on the record made sure that this procedure, he's like, I think Mr. Minter first said he was locked in, and then I had to go and say, no one could appeal this procedure because I don't think the trial court thought it was correct.
So if this court makes a determination of whether or not this is a jury question, that issue is not even raised by your case. You're saying we came, it's as if somebody agrees to a bench trial and then on appeal says, wait a minute, this case should have been a jury trial.
But we didn't agree to a bench trial. We did not agree for the judge to be a fact finder. I think that's where we're having the disconnect, Justice Patterson. We agreed that...
Who was the fact finder on that issue? There was none, right?
Admittedly, I only had to survive the motion, and it was going to be agreed by counsel then that MT was going to be vicariously liable for Giamello, the forklift operator. Why wouldn't I take that?
I'm not at all in any way doubting your strategic abilities whatsoever, counsel. That's not what I'm saying. I'm not fighting with you over whether you take the deal. The point is, what was done in this case, and what needs to be done going forward.
Well, going forward, I think the defendant has to be held to their bargain, to the bargain. That was a negotiated multiple times on the record. I mean, as you can see through the transcript, it's talked about on numerous days of the trial. And at the critical day, when the judge, the trial court, was about to say, you know what, we've started taking testimony and documents are coming in that only I'm seeing on this issue. Let's turn the ship around because I think it's a fact question. The parties had agreed to go forward under this frame. And the day before, defense counsel was like, oh, I might make the motion under 437 after the plaintiff, since the plaintiff rested, and then ultimately decided, no, I want to put on my evidence on the borrowed servant doctrine, make the motion once. They knew that they were making it under some type of motion for judgment standard that was not, to say that there was any other type of agreement or that the plaintiff somehow was inviting error, I agree with you, Judge. Under this agreement, ultimately, that question was never decided. But that was what the agreement was, and that's why we agreed to it. It was an advantage for our client. The judge is going to decide it, but on a 440 standard. So if we survive the motion, that's as if the judge found MT was vicariously liable.
Can I just ask one clarifying question?
Sure.
Previously in your conversation with Justice Patterson, you seemed to agree that it was your burden, but I thought that the borrowed employee question is actually an affirmative defense. So it was actually the defense's burden to show that the employee was a borrowed employee.
Correct. Yes. Thank you.
So it was defense's burden, and then you had this agreement that you reached, and then you're asking us to, I guess, as you said, hold defendant to the agreement.
As we believe the agreement to be, and it had to be that way. I mean, if we survive the motion, that's a finding that was going to act as the finding that MT was liable for GML, the forklift operator's conduct. And there's
that part of the agreement?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very clear. They're going to make the motion by 440. If they win it, we've lost.
But I mean, did you talk about what the ramifications would be if it went one way or
another? It can never go to the jury. If we won the motion, if we won the 440 motion, it can never go to the jury because witnesses and evidence was being only shown to the trial court. So nobody else can make the decision. What the agreement was is they're making it under a motion for judgment standard. And if we win, if we defeat it, that would act as the finding. We'll uphold the jury. And actually, since the judge reserved on it, we just instructed the jury that for their purposes, they're assumed that MT is liable for GML's conduct, and then determine whether or not GML, the forklift operator, breached his duty of care when he operated the forklift, which obviously the jury, found that he did. And then the court ultimately, 6 months later, in June of the next year, finally decided the motion after extensive post-trial briefing on the issue.
Let me ask you something more broad, putting aside the procedure in this case, more broadly in terms of Galveo. Galveo has revised the standard. It's now like a six-part test, four parts on control, two parts on business furtherance. Is there anything about that revised version of the test that structurally or systemically is presents challenges for saying all of these things are jury questions. And I'll just tease out one example for you. One of the factors is, did the general employer have the right to terminate the negligent employee or negligent worker? Did they have a right to terminate? Is that the kind of question that we want jurors to evaluate, the legal right to terminate somebody? Is that, are you perfectly fine with, let's just explain all this to the jury in some jury charge and they'll figure it out?
Well, it's really those factors, Judge, are, you know, were part of the business furtherance test, which prior case law was saying was a question of fact. So I can't come up here and stand and say that it's not. I mean,
there's no reason for us to revisit that here. There's no reason to rethink if any of this is.
It's just a melding
of the jury's ken.
Okay. Right, it's a synchronization. They took some factors of control, they took some factors of business furtherance, and said these are what we want to look at in the borrowed servant context. Because really, really, all you're doing, it's the same analysis. Even if you had one employer, right? You have an employee that is negligent, right? Is it right to hold the employer vicariously liable? Or somebody else hold them liable for this person's conduct? Do they exert enough control? Do they get enough benefit? So it doesn't change just because you potentially have two entities that may be liable. And the Supreme Court in Galvao said you could have dual. They both could exert enough control and get enough of a benefit. So it doesn't change the fundamental question of, is it equitable to hold somebody else liable for somebody else's conduct? Remember, this isn't a direct claim against MT, right? It's not a failure to train, supervise, the employer. One of their employees was negligent, and should they be vicariously liable for that? And, you know, I think it's pretty clear that we give that to the jury. I mean, even now, just on the example where it's only one employer or one potential employer, I mean, they give them, I think it's up to 11 factors that we give the jury to have to consider. So I don't think the analysis in Galvao is any more stringent or more difficult than that alone.
You agree that your client could not recover from CSNJ because of the workman's compensation bar, correct?
Correct.
So is this giving your client some sort of unfair windfall to recover from MT just because of how CSNJ and MT decided to structure their business relationship?
No, because, I mean, it's clear that in any case, a defendant never gets to have the employer on the verdict sheet. They never get a credit or an apportionment from the employer. So MT doesn't stand in any worse or better position than any other co-defendant would have been or any other defendant would have been when when the employer, another employer, was potentially liable. There was another question on the record, and I forgot what day of the transcript it was, I forget, but we had a long discussion about, you know, saying Judge Bradshaw, the trial court asked, who would have paid, you know, GM Mella's, not my client, if GM Mella got hurt, right? Who would have the workers' compensation claim been? MT or CSNJ? And nobody knew. I had submitted it certainly would have been MT because he's a W-2 employee over there, but you can go through the control test and everything else. But, you know, be that as it may, no, I don't think MT stood in worse position or better position than any defendant that faces an employer, another employer who may be negligent, but you don't get to get that apportionment on the verdict sheet.
Anything else you'd like to present? Minter, brief rebuttal.
Just very quickly, and I appreciate the court's indulgence. I wanted to address one thing on the website that Your Honor brought up. One of the things that I think is important in what you were citing from, Justice, the first sentence on that website says, quote, in conjunction with Container Services of New Jersey, an affiliated company. So it was not proclaiming that MT did all these things. And I think that's important to point out.
I think conjunction means you're doing something along with someone else. I think, you know, Justice Wiener, after pointing out the website information, because you noted that the appellate division came up with these inferences out of whole cloth and out of thin air. So I understand the point you're making, but in conjunction means both companies are doing it. It's being done along with another company, right?
Respectfully, my reading of that is here are services that our affiliated companies perform. This was a service performed by Container Services.
And it should have just said that. Well, I mean, you noted that it was inartfully written on the website.
I'm just reacting to when the discussion about the website, that sentence was not brought up. So I wanted to make sure that it identified.
Let me ask you about the procedural issue that we were just discussing.
Sure.
Do you agree with your adversary's characterization of the procedural issue here?
What your
adversary is saying is that you collectively came up with
yes.
an agreement.
Yes.
To take the issue away from the jury and
yes.
to substitute for that, not a fact-finding by the trial court in which your adversary would have the burden, but a motion procedure that would shift the burden, in essence, to you.
Clearly, what was said on the record was said on the record in the heat of trying a case. So there's no, I'm not going to run away from anything I said.
I'm not asking about specific statements on the record.
I'm going to tell you what I thought we were doing.
And what's your contention?
About what we were doing was we were taking the borrowed servant doctrine issue away from the jury. And there was really one witness. We all agreed who the witness was. It was Mr. Santomo, tell the jury to come in at 10:30. The court would take the testimony from Mr. Santomo on the borrowed servant doctrine issue outside of the presence of the jury. So all the inferences that you talk about that are typical, that doesn't make any sense when you're taking that issue away from the jury, and he heard that issue then.
Are you contending that if the court agrees with the appellate division as to this being an issue of law,
okay,
that are you agreeing with your adversary that the case is over, as opposed to going back for a remand on the issue of the borrowed servant?
Yeah, I think the answer is yes. What I'm urging the court to do is to reverse the appellate division and reinstate the trial court's dismissal. So yes, I don't think either side. Certainly, either side's not asking for a redo on damages, or I don't think anyone's asking for a redo.
I'm not talking about damages. I'm talking about the issue. Are you concerned that the issue of the borrowed servant, okay, was never decided by any fact finder?
I'm not, and I'll tell you why. I believed, and I know we talk about it as a matter of law and a matter of fact, but I think we use those terms, or I'll admit using those terms somewhat loosely. Clearly, what Judge Bradshaw was doing is he had to make factual determinations.
This whole case is about whether this was an issue of law or an issue of fact. So that's really an important distinction.
But there can be issues where you're deciding an issue as a matter of law, the court's deciding it, but there's mixed questions of fact in there. And I think that's what this was. And I think, respectfully, that Judge Bradshaw, you know, got it right here.
And if this court does not agree with you on that point, do you agree with your adversary that the jury verdict gets reinstated?
No. I mean, we're asking, in other words, or do I think that if there's some other middle ground where this court sends it back for a jury, I just want to make sure
I'm trying to understand what the remedy is here, okay? And I was asking your adversary about, does there need to be a jury determination of, in essence, an element of this claim, which is vicarious liability, right?
Right.
If, in fact, the procedure that was used and the way the trial court handled this was not right.
My
adversary is saying loud and clear, no, this was, we agreed that this is how it would play out. I'm asking you, do you agree that you agreed that that's how it should play out?
I'm probably pushing back because I don't want to agree with my adversary, but I should agree with him on it. We made an agreement. Okay. We agreed to live by what Judge Bradshaw decided. I'm here because I believe the appellate division got it wrong, so I'm not seeking to go back to
the
trial.
Thank you.
Yes. So if there's no other questions, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. Can I just ask you one follow-up question? I just heard representation that neither side wants this to go back and redo on damages. Whether you win or whether you lose on the legal arguments that have been presented, do you agree with that?
Yes, I think it was on the record, too, that nobody wanted this to have to go back to trial. That's why I was so adamant with Justice Patterson saying.
I think a yes or a no was all we needed.
Yes.
Thank you. And that's a yes. You too yes. do not want it to go back on damages under however the court would analyze.
No, we were supposed to abide by the jury's verdict, and the judge was either going to uphold it or not uphold the verdict.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel. We'll take the matter under advice.